This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is off today. I'm here with my law partner, Taylor Aysen, and a colleague, Trevor Savage. And we're going to talk about a case that they just tried to verdict a couple of weeks ago. First of all, congratulations, guys. That was an amazing result in a really hard case, a difficult venue with practically no pretrial settlement offer. So I'm personally grateful to you for generating revenue for our law firm, but great job.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
I thought it would be an interesting case to discuss on the podcast because I think there are several issues that came up during trial that have universal application, and the fact pattern, the injury claimed in the case is complex regional pain syndrome, which I know a lot of plaintiff's lawyers encounter in their practice and can be sometimes a challenging, somewhat confounding set of injuries to present to a jury. Before we get into all of that, can you just, Taylor, maybe give us the backstory about the case? What was the case about and how did it set up for trial?
It was a strange med mal case in that the medicine itself, the mechanism of injury was not all that complicated, but the damages piece was really the more complicated piece. But the case involved a woman in her early 60s at the time, now late 60s, who went in for an ERCP, which is an endoscopic procedure to look at her, an obstruction. It's a very routine procedure. And she was placed on a fluoroscopy table with her stomach down. And a fluoroscopy table moves in order to move the dye around and get imaging. And for some reason, she was uncomfortable putting one of her arms down by her side, which is how you're supposed to be positioned. That the idea is to position both arms down by your side and tuck in your arms. So they left her left arm up by her head and turned the lights off and began the procedure. And when the lights came back on, when they tried to move her, they realized her left arm was stuck and they had to move the table to get her arm out. And then her arm had an injury to it that everybody agreed was due to the procedure. The big disagreement in the trial was what kind of injury it was or how serious it was. Sort of that one way to think about the disagreement in the trial is we called it a crush injury throughout the trial. The defendants called it a pinch injury. That sort of summarizes it.
What happened to her afterward?
She lives in a very rural part of the state, probably the most rural part of the state, in a French-speaking community way up north. And she had continued pain in her arm, but nobody knew why or did much to help her figure out why. We got involved in the case about a year after the injury, and we ended up sending her about 2 years after the injury to a pain specialist in Rhode Island who diagnosed her with complex regional pain syndrome. One of the difficulties of the case, of course, is that the person who diagnosed the condition was a retained expert. And obviously that came up quite a bit during the case. But as our expert pointed out, it wasn't particularly surprising that somebody in rural Maine wouldn't have gotten that diagnosis. And actually, a physical therapist she had seen had posited that she may have CRPS. But so she got that diagnosis, and her arm of course, the first time our expert was deposed, our pain expert, they asked him, well, you didn't take any photographs. Why didn't you take any photographs? And so when she went to see him again, he took some photographs. And I think those photographs were pretty powerful. They showed, among other things, that her left arm was atrophying. I mean, it was noticeably thinner than her right arm. And this really became a case about photographs, the photographs of the injury, the photographs of her arm taken by our pain expert, which they, the defendants, sort of strongly implied that at least some of those photographs may have been doctored. So the veracity of the photographs and the meaning of the photographs became a centerpiece of the case.
And can you just explain what, for those who don't know, what is CRPS?
CRPS is a pain condition, complex regional pain syndrome. It's a pain condition where essentially the pain is in your brain, not in the place where you actually are injured. And what happens is the nerves signal to the brain that you're in pain. What happens with CRPS is at some point, there's rewiring that happens in your brain so that your brain continues to think you have a trauma even when it's gone. It's sort of like analogous to phantom limb syndrome, where your brain is telling you something is there when it's not. It's a very painful condition. And one of the problems with the condition is that you stop using your limb because it's just too painful. Our client tried to use her limb, and you're told to try to use your limb, but it's very, very painful. So over time, your limb starts to atrophy and eventually often is unusable.
One of the challenges that I've seen in CRPS cases is that one of the distinguishing features of that condition is that you have pain disproportionate to the trauma or injury that you suffered. And because of that, it becomes hard for people to believe that someone could be experiencing this kind of intractable, lifelong pain syndrome from what could be a relatively minor event. Did that issue come into play in this case?
Yeah, it did. It was confounded in some ways by the fact that our client is a real mainer, by which I mean not somebody who likes to complain. I mean, she was a very tough woman who had worked in a mill, which is a very physically difficult job, in her 20s. She was one of the only women to work in this huge mill. And she's not somebody who likes to whine. And Trevor and I spent a lot of time thinking about how we were going to convey to the jury what was going on with her when she was so resistant to being vulnerable. What I came to realize, I think, in part reading Jesse Wilson's book and also just thinking through the case, and for those who haven't read Jesse Wilson, he's a consultant who is an actor who writes about witness prep. What I came to realize was that our client's disinclination to feel sorry for herself and to complain was actually a strength of the case, not a weakness, and that we needed to embrace and show the jury that she was a fighter and that she didn't spend her days feeling sorry for herself, that she was trying to live her life independently. And once I realized that, the damages piece really came together.
I had the opportunity to meet this client at least one time. I recall we were talking about the case, and I said something to her about how at some point we're going to have to present this case to the jury. And she responded to me, "Fuck the jury." And I remember thinking, that doesn't seem like the best mindset going into this. But she was a very strong-willed, tough, opinionated person who I know really grew close to you guys as part of the work you did in this case, and you earned her trust over time. But working with her to prepare her and to get her into the right mindset to testify, I know was an enormous challenge. How did you go about doing that?
What I've come to believe is that, and I just have to tell myself this when I'm preparing for trial over and over again, is that you're never going to finish trial and say, I spent too much time with my client. It wasn't worth it. At least that's never happened to me. Every hour I spend with a client, I brings benefit. So she lives, as I said, she lives 8 hours from us, or 7 hours. Maine is a huge state, and she lives far away. So at first, I wasn't going to go up there and spend time with her. I was going to meet her and spend a couple hours in the middle of the state here and there. Then I just said to myself, I have to go up there. And I went up and spent a couple days with her. And that was a huge moment for me and her, in part because I think it made her realize that I really cared about the case. And it changed our relationship. And I think she began to really trust me in a way she doesn't trust a lot of people. And we really connected during that trip. I drove with her at one point to Rhode Island to go see Dr. Chopra, our expert. We just spent many, many hours together. And at one point, I just said to her, I want to hear your whole life story. And she spent like 2 hours telling me everything about what had happened in her life. And you don't know what's going to be important until you hear that. And I came away from this trial thinking, I wish I had done this earlier. I wish I had put in this time a year before trial rather than a couple months before trial. But we spend so much time in medical malpractice cases thinking about liability and causation, in part because of the panel system we have in Maine, but also because people who do these cases like us, we like the difficult legal and medical issues. I always feel, even in a case like this where I spent so much time with the client, I think I should have done more. It's never enough. But that time we spent with her paid huge dividends.
I know that we did a data study in this case, and you always saw the value in this case, Taylor, and that was something I was very impressed with, because I think this is a case that a lot of people could look at and see that you had a 60-year-old woman who essentially had a bruise to her arm in a surgery and then had no real medical diagnosis that came out of that and complained of ongoing pain. But you saw the value in the case enough to find the right expert who could get her the correct diagnosis, the CRPS. And we invested a substantial amount of resources doing this case. In fact, I think we invested more money in the case, just out-of-pocket expenses, than we ever received as a settlement offer. But why do you think you saw value here where others didn't? And how did that data study help in terms of trying to confirm what the value was here?
Yeah, so I think it's a few things. I mean, one is this case came with us from our last firm. And one of the things that you and I had talked about when we began this firm is, if we're going to do a case, we're going to do it right. We're not going to, once we're in, we're going to be all in. And that's the way I tried to approach this case, is to do it with the highest level of work we could. And then you sort of let the chips fall where they may. But what I also realized talking to the defense lawyers about this case is they didn't take it seriously, but there was no real reason for that. It wasn't because they had thought through the case. It was because because they had not encountered plaintiff's lawyers who were willing to really aggressively litigate these cases. But CRPS is a nightmare diagnosis. And I realized that what our client was going through, particularly as a woman living alone, was profound and extremely difficult. And actually, I mean, the paralegal on this case, Catherine, who really pushed me at one point to not settle this case for a small sum, and pointed out to me that our client really, as a woman living alone, needed help. And I really appreciated that. At that point, when she pushed me, I needed that. And then when we did the data study, what I saw, and it's something we all kind of know, but it's interesting to see it, is that the liability and jurors' anger over liability really pushed the damages in this case that were connected to the damages. And Trevor ended up putting on the liability case, but the defense lawyer wanted to stipulate to liability on the first day of trial, and we said absolutely not. The reason for that, of course, is we knew that the jurors' anger, if we could get the jurors angry about what had happened at this hospital, which was outrageous, that was going to affect damages. And Trevor did a really effective job of showing system failures in this case that I think helped us get the verdict we got.
So that's a good transition to Trevor. So Trevor, you came into the case toward the end of it to help Taylor try it and ended up taking the lead on the liability side of the case. What were your first impressions of the case when you first started to learn about it?
Yeah, I joined the case. I think I parachuted in December or January, and then we tried it in March. It's one of those cases, and Taylor's right, where figuring out a way to make the jury angry about the care that this corporation provided and making them feel like this could be me, this could be my family, that was going to be the big driver of damages. And so my approach was to try to make the jury as angry as possible in showing exactly how broken the system was that was providing care for Louise and for all the people in that community. So the way that we tried to do it was to show how there were five people primarily involved in her care. There was a gastroenterologist who was doing the procedure. There was a nurse anesthetist. There was an anesthesiologist. There were nurses who were all supposed to be working as a team to provide her care. And each of those five people made the same mistake at the same time in the same room that resulted in her arm being crushed. And basically asking the jury the rhetorical question, how does that happen? How do five people in the same room make the same mistake at the same time? And that's because the system is broken. They don't have safe protocols and procedures in place to make sure that this doesn't happen. And that was what we were really trying to do to help drive up the anger and the liability side.
What evidence did you adduce at trial to support the system failure argument that you were just sharing?
Yeah. So what each of them testified, sort of the five people, the nurse anesthetist, the anesthesiologist, the proceduralist, and the nurses, they all said this is a group responsibility. Making sure that patients are properly positioned is a group responsibility. And what we were able to demonstrate through the case of through discovery and then into trial is that because it was a group responsibility, really it was no one's responsibility. And everyone else assumed that everyone else was going to be taking care of this. And so at the beginning, sort of chronologically, what happened is Louise, our client, went in and like Taylor said, they told her to lay down on the fluoroscopy table and that she needed to have her arms at her sides tucked in. And for whatever reason, it was uncomfortable for her to do that. And so the nurse anesthetist, who it was her very first day in this endoscopy floor, it was the first procedure like this. She was a traveler. She had never been to this hospital. She had no idea what the protocols were, what the safety procedures were. She said, okay, put your arm up above your head. And she testified at trial that normally she has positioning devices, things to keep the arm secure so that it doesn't fall off the table over the course of the procedure. And she testified, she asked about that, and the anesthesiologist told her, we don't do that. And the nurses told her, we don't do that. And so she said, okay, I guess we don't do that. And one of the nurses who was working with Louise at the beginning, trying to get her arms positioned, said, okay, we can't have her arm up above her head for this procedure. We need to have her arms by her sides during her procedure. But then she went and left for her lunch break. So she left this nurse anesthetist alone to take care of this. Again, on her very first procedure at this new hospital. Then Louise goes under and the new nurse comes in to replace her. And the new nurse, the procedure's already begun by the time she comes in. And so the lights are down, the towel's up, no one can see where her arm is. And the new nurse doesn't make anything of it. And the new nurse says, if she had seen that, she would have made sure that Louise's arm was secured by her side. So you have two people, sort of ships crossing in the night, two people that knew this is not acceptable to have a patient's arm unsecured, both of whom, if they had known that it was, would have fixed it, but both of whom had no responsibility to fix it, and so they didn't. And then you had the other nurse who was in charge of the procedure, who we got to testify for the first time at trial. She had no idea that a patient's arms were supposed to be by their sides during this procedure. She had no idea that their arms couldn't be up by their head during this procedure. She was unaware of any policies, any procedures for patient positioning for this procedure. And then the proceduralist and the x-ray technologist both sort of testified that, yeah, I mean, it's our responsibility to see this. And if we had seen it, we would have made sure that her arm was secured, but we didn't see it. And so all throughout that process, it just became very clear that, again, because everyone is responsible for this, nobody's responsible. And even though there was documentation showing they all signed off on the position and confirmed, there's a piece of paper that said, ready to go into procedure. I forget what it said. They checked the box off, but at trial, they clearly that wasn't the case. And then we also hit on the fact that, and the defense objected multiple times, and we kept chipping away at it, that the hospital still, to this day, has no procedures whatsoever on patient positioning. All the different nurses and proceduralists, they all check to make sure a patient's arm is secured because they personally are concerned about it because of what happened to Louise, but the hospital never did anything. They launched an investigation into this, investigation in air quotes, but they don't even know what that investigation showed. They didn't take notes. They didn't write it down. And so all throughout this process, I think that was, I think, fairly shocking to the jury how laissez-faire the hospital was about what had happened.
One thing Trevor did really well, too, is, and this is something we were thinking about, I think, Ben, that you had done it at trial really effectively, was showing the difference between a lawyer saying my client takes responsibility and a client really taking responsibility. So the lawyer got up in his opening, the defense lawyer, he's a talented lawyer, and he said, this hospital takes responsibility for what happened. But we knew that the proceduralist had testified that he didn't think anything different could have been done to stop this. And Trevor elicited that. And that always, part of you gets nervous, right? Because you think, well, if they've admitted liability, why are we really going to elicit this opinion that nothing could have been done? But we did. And our liability expert was sitting in the courtroom when this guy testified, nothing could have been done. And he was floored by it. He called it shocking. And you could tell the jury agreed. So Trevor worked really hard to show whatever that lawyer says, that's not really taking responsibility.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
I know one of the issues here that you confronted was that our client had a prior medical history of complaints relating to the same limb. I think she had a motor vehicle accident in the distant past at some point, and then it applied for Social Security disability. And the defense sought to use that to call into doubt that her current complaints were related to the surgical injuries as opposed to prior issues. How did that play out at trial?
Yeah, that was frustrating because we fought hard to keep that evidence out and we couldn't. And at some point, I just had to switch from that mode of trying to keep it out to embracing it. I was very worried about that evidence because the injury in some ways was very similar in some of her complaints. But the trump card we had was that their own damages expert agreed with us that the injury our client had was from this incident. So what we did was we essentially used it. We brought it out, of course, in her direct. And then when they pushed on it, we pointed out in the closing, or I did, that how cynical it was, because I pointed out they don't believe this pre-existing condition has anything to do with this case. Their own expert says it doesn't. What they're doing is, this is a cynical attempt to basically suggest that because this woman had an injury in the past, she isn't entitled to a verdict now. So we kind of made that part of the way we polarized the case.
So there was a big issue that came up the 11th hour, I think the night before you closed and the case came to a conclusion. Do you want to tell us about that issue and how you dealt with it?
You want to take that, Trevor?
Yeah. So Louise had testified. She was on the stand for about 6.5 hours. I mean, there were two defendants. They kept her on the stand forever. And they were asking her about all the different ways that this injury had affected her. And at one point, she was talking about how the other day at the grocery store, she was grocery shopping and she looked down at her left arm. That was the arm that was crushed and said, I'm going to put you to work today. And so she picked up an 8-pack of Gatorade and tried to carry it across the grocery store parking lot, and only made it a certain portion of the way across the parking lot before she couldn't handle it anymore. And she said that she did that because her doctor had told her, you need to use your arm. I know it hurts. I know it's difficult. You need to use your arm. And the defense was asking her about that. And they also asked her a bunch of different questions, sort of obscure, about, in this situation, what do you do? So for example, they said, if you take the trash out, what do you do? And she said, I'll use my right arm to throw it down my apartment stairs to the bottom and then pick it up from there and carry it, you know, out to the trash bin. And they said, if you need to open your car door, what do you do? And she said, well, I'll use my right arm. And that's the arm that wasn't injured. And so we thought her testimony, you know, she did a great job. And it was the second to last day of trial. All we had left was their defense expert, their liability expert on Friday, the last day of trial, and then closings. And on Thursday afternoon, we go into chambers and the judge is asking us, okay, what do you have tomorrow? What's the plan? The defense lawyer says, we have one more witness. And I can't speak for Taylor, but my heart just fell into my stomach. And he said, we put surveillance on her, on Louise, and we want to introduce photos and videos of that surveillance in court tomorrow. And immediately Taylor and I said, absolutely not. This witness was not on your witness list. None of the photos or videos you want to show are on your exhibit list. You know, absolutely not. And ultimately the videos showed, as we learned pretty late that evening, they showed Louise doing things like going grocery shopping and carrying groceries in her left hand, using her left arm, the arm that was injured, opening car doors with her left arm, carrying a bag of trash with her left hand, things that she had testified she usually does with her right arm.
They clearly structured their cross of her in a premeditated fashion to bring out facts that they were then going to confront her on with the video surveillance later.
Yeah. And in fact, the judge told us at one point, she told the defense attorneys at one point, you know, when you started asking her about some of those questions, I thought, I wonder if they have a PI on her. And so what we learned was they had hired a private investigator to follow her for 143 hours to try to find video, you know, of her to prove she was a fake. So our initial reaction to this was obviously to try to exclude it. And you actually helped us with this, Ben. We filed a motion to exclude all the photos and videos and for sanctions, essentially saying this is a discovery violation. We had asked you for all photos and videos of our client, and you had a continuing obligation to supplement your discovery. And then obviously at the time that you did this surveillance, that fell within that those discovery requests you never supplemented. And I thought we had a really good argument on that. The judge dismissed that out of hand the next day and said, this is classic impeachment evidence. They had no duty to disclose it. I'm going to let it in. And I think that in hindsight, maybe this is wishful thinking, that this actually helped the case. Because all throughout the case, like Taylor said, their approach to it was, we're taking responsibility. We're taking responsibility for what happened. And we were able to polarize it to show this is the hospital taking responsibility. They crush our client's arm and then call her a liar and a cheat for 5 years and then hire a private investigator to stalk her for 143 hours to show that she's a liar and a cheat. And so they put on their investigator the first thing that morning. And he said, yep, these are the photos I took. Yep, these are the videos I took. And I cross-examined him that morning and basically said, you understand that the hospital crushed my client's arm, right? Yes. Are you aware that my client testified earlier this week that she does use her left hand sometimes to grocery shop and things like that, right? No, I wasn't aware of that. Okay. Well, she did that. Did you know that she does that because her doctors told her to do that? No, I didn't. And they told her to do that so that her arm doesn't continue to lose strength, so that it doesn't atrophy. She's trying her best to do it, even though it hurts. Did you know that? No, I didn't know that. And you followed her for 143 hours, right? Yeah. Over the course of 4 years, right? Yeah. And the hospital paid you $13,000 to do that over the course of 4 years, right? Yeah. And what you have is, out of that 4 years of tailing her around, is 3.5 minutes of video of her doing exactly what she's already told this jury she does anyway, which is that sometimes she uses her left hand to go grocery shopping and to carry things, right? Yes. And by framing it that way, we had two options when this surveillance video dropped on us. We could have acted indignant and angry and freaked out about it, or we could have acted like this is insurance defense lawyers doing what insurance companies want them to do. And how gross is this? And the jury really took their cues from us. And I think, and I'll credit you for this, Ben, because this was some of your guidance on the issue, which was, if you don't freak out about it, the jury's not going to freak out about it. They're going to take their cues from you. And sure enough, I don't want to read too much into it, but I don't think that those videos, after we were done cross-examining their private investigator and after Taylor did the closing, I don't think those videos did anything to hurt our case. In fact, I think it helped polarize the case of showing the contrast between, okay, here's their talented lawyer saying that the hospital takes responsibility. Does stalking a 67-year-old woman for 4 years to prove she's a liar and a cheat, is that taking responsibility? And I think that was a really effective way of polarizing it.
It was an interesting situation where I do think how you respond to something like that is so important. And I was just too close to it. And I was upset, obviously, to see this evidence in the last day of trial. And I felt like everything we'd done was for naught. But when I talked it through with you, Ben, and I realized my instinct was completely wrong to make a scene about it. And you said, you guys should just act like you've known about this and you don't, it's not a big deal. And I actually, once we lost, and once the judge ruled it was coming in, I said to the judge, Your Honor, we don't want to object. We want you to make a ruling that we're going to preserve our objection without objecting in front of the jury. And she agreed we could do that. So we just acted as nonchalant as possible. And Trevor actually said at one point in his cross, when he talked about the fact that Louise had testified, she tried to use her arm. Trevor said, what are you doing here? Which, of course, drew an objection. But it made the point very clearly to the jury that there's nothing to see here. And the evidence, what the photos weren't good. But for us, but they weren't horrific either. I mean, they were our client using one hand to open the trash can, lifting the trash bag with the other hand, or carrying the bags in both hands. There was nothing devastating. So I feel like it would have been a different situation if there had been a really devastating photo. But the photos as they were, I think, weren't bad enough for the jury to think it was appropriate to spy on our client. That was my read.
Yeah. And then the other thing I forgot about was the judge required that the defense provide us all the photos and all the videos that they took. And again, there was out of, I think, Taylor, Kathy did the math on it, was like 8,000 minutes of video they took.
Well, that's how many minutes they billed for their investigation.
Yeah. That's how many minutes they billed. Right. So there was all of the videos and all the photos they took, and then they were required to specify, here's what we're actually going to move to admit, which was like 3 minutes and 30 seconds. And among the videos that they decided not to admit, you know, there was one video of Louise pulling up into an ATM and opening her car window and then leaning her entire body to the left out the car window, just so that she could use her right hand, the non-injured hand, to push the buttons on the pin pad, which is obviously she was doing gymnastics in the car to try to avoid using her left arm to push buttons on an ATM pin pad. And so I asked the private investigator, do you remember following her into a bank parking lot? Yeah. And do you remember that she contorted her arm across her body just to use her right arm? I remember that. Yeah. And the defense experts didn't ask you to show the jury those photos or those videos, did they? No, they didn't. And so that also, I think, helped create the effect that we wanted, which is out of this 8,000 videos that you were stalking her, 3.5 minutes were actually helpful, you think were helpful to you. And the remaining minutes did absolutely nothing to advance your argument. And in fact, helped our argument to show she was quite injured by this.
One of the things we've talked about is because in Maine, you can't talk to the jurors immediately after a trial. You have to wait till their jury service period is elapsed, and then you have to obtain permission from the court in order to do that. But it would be very interesting to talk to this jury pool and to find out what impact the surveillance video had on them, because my instinct is similar to yours, that I think in the end, probably helped you and served to polarize the case and probably increase the verdict value above would have been without it. Because the ability for them to walk that tightrope of trying to look like they're good corporate citizens, they're taking responsibility, but yet they're trailing this old woman around in a very sleazy way and spying on her over the course of 4 years, including things as very personal and private as going into your ATM machine and entering your code into the PIN pad. That almost seems like a criminal act to be watching somebody do that. It just seems incredibly lowbrow and sleazy and makes them look bad unless what they obtained from that is highly valuable. And what's interesting is when I watched the video, you sent it to me that night, I thought it was potentially problematic because it did show her using that affected arm in different ways. But once you get the context of it, of the 143 hours the investigator was trailing her, and this was all they had to show for it, it almost proves the opposite. Because although it does show her doing some low-level actions with the left arm, it doesn't show very much. So if that's the best they have, I think by inference, it almost makes your case for you. Transitioning from that to the closing. So Taylor, how did you pull it all together in the closing and address the issue of the liability, the video surveillance, and then tell us how you asked for money, how did you decide what to ask for, and then what was the verdict amount, and what was the highest offer that was made pre-verdict?
Yeah, before I get into the closing, I just wanted to add that I think what makes medical malpractice trials hard, I think especially in smaller counties, this was in Bangor, Maine, which is a city, but it's a small city, and this is a big hospital there. You're playing against a home field team that's a big employer in the community and also an important part of the community. I mean, this hospital is connected to everybody in that community. We learned that clearly picking the jury. And so to succeed, you have to knock some of the sheen off the hospital because otherwise, they're just the home team. So the closing was, I think, went in really well. What was interesting is there was a computer malfunction, so I lost my slides for a bit of it. But actually, that was a good thing because slides can be useful. But in a closing, you also want the jury really looking right at you. And when I lost my slides, I just had their complete attention. And the closing was, a lot of it was about liability and talking about what a mess this hospital was. But then I really aggressively polarized the case and I used the surveillance, just another example of the way the hospital had behaved to Louise and it behaved during the trial. I mean, the trial became about the trial, about the way the trial had been conducted, as sort of standing in for who the hospital was. And I juxtaposed this idea of taking responsibility with the reality of calling, basically insinuating our client was a liar, spying on her, denigrating her. And I pointed out to the jury, you know, this is a hospital that's behaving like a cigarette company. And what was interesting is after my closing, the first sense I had that things were going well was the defendant's closing was very defensive because using the polarizing techniques where you say, Mr. Defense Lawyer is too polite to say this. When he argues X, Y, and Z, what he's saying is, our client's a liar. And if you believe she's a liar, you should throw her out without any money. But if you don't believe that, don't give him a discount for saying we take responsibility. That's just as about a discount. That's all he wants. And when he stood up, he was extremely defensive. He said, I never called her a liar. Yes, we did surveillance, but what are we supposed to do? Just take her word for it? And when I saw how defensive he was and how difficult it was for him to deal with the way we polarized the case, I thought, wow, we have some traction here. We caught him off guard. Because I think defense lawyers are so used to picking apart cases and feeling like they don't have to answer for it. They don't have to make an argument. They don't have to say she's a liar. They just show inconsistencies and hope the jury makes an inference they want the jury to make. So once you put them in that position of having to make an argument, they become very uncomfortable. So that's when I sort of felt like our things were coming together really well. So what ended up, there were two defendants in this case. There was the hospital, and there was this nurse anesthetist who, as Trevor mentioned, was not an employee. The clerk read the verdict incorrectly and suggested at first that the jury had found no causation against the hospital, which was wrong, as the foreman pointed out. But what the jury had done is found negligence against both defendants and then found no causation against the nurse anesthetist, interestingly. Although that's sort of, we invited the jury to basically see her as a victim as well. So she was a nice person and we were fine with that. And then they awarded $2.4 million against Eastern Maine Medical Center. And as you pointed out, we had never really gotten a serious offer in this case. Although one thing that made me feel like we were also getting traction is that the defense lawyer suggested a verdict of $300,000 about. I forget, he came up with his own methodology. So that was another thing that made me think, okay, well, they're taking this a little more seriously. They're worried about, it was smart of him to try to anchor down, but it made me realize they're taking this a little more seriously today than they were a week ago. Oh, you had asked me about what we had asked for. So I actually asked for less than the big data study suggested, because the number they suggested, it didn't make a big difference in terms of what they found for outcome, and I couldn't get myself to it. And I just felt like I needed to stick with a number I was felt comfortable with. I asked for $10 million. Although I didn't really ask for it, I used the Nick Rowley man in the black suit, which I find to be very effective, especially in cases like this. And I, in my example, I used the $10 million number. It was clear to the jury, I think, that that's where I thought it should be, but I didn't actually come out and directly ask for it. And I knew from the data study and from knowing Bangor, they were going to think that was insane. But it didn't, what we knew from the data study was asking for that kind of number in this case didn't lower our win rate. In some cases, asking for too high of a number can lower your win rate. That wasn't happening here. And the win rate was so high anyway that we knew we were going to get some sort of verdict. At least we thought we were. So the thinking was, you ask for a number like that, they say, those guys are crazy. We're not going to give that number. But they're still anchored to give a bigger number.
Just to follow up on that, it was funny. After the defense lawyer suggested 300,000, and after the closings had finished, he walked over to the adjuster for the insurance carrier, and we heard him say to the adjuster for the insurance carrier, I think the jury comes back between 300,000 and 500,000 on this, which was interesting that even after he suggested that low number, he still expected it would exceed that number. And then obviously it was, the end result was far, far higher than even that prediction.
Well, it's an amazing result. I want to point out to our listeners in far-flung locations like Los Angeles or Austin, Texas, that a $2.4 million verdict in the state of Maine will be one of the highest verdicts that our state will have for the entire year. We might have two or three or four seven-figure verdicts a year in this state. So you have to put that on the appropriate scale to understand the significance of a verdict like that here in a state like Maine.
Can you remember the last seven-figure verdict in Bangor? I think it was when we were at Berman and Simmons. It's my recollection. It was the Nason verdict, I think, but I'm not sure.
I feel like there's been one since. I'd have to go back and look, but they're few and far between in this state, and that's a significant verdict here. So congratulations, guys. A great job. And just the thoughtfulness and strategic care that went into preparing this case, all of the elements of it, from gaining the trust of the client, finding her the right doctor who could not only testify, but actually diagnose her medical condition appropriately, working up the liability side of the case with the system failure, getting a great expert to come and testify about that, all the way down to dealing with the 11th hour surprise surveillance video. You guys did an incredible job.
Thank you.
And thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thanks for your help as well, Ben.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.